So wanted to share with you a little bit, and as you were saying, this is a sacred time of year, and in recognition of that, kind of, for all these years, we've tried to talk about the Buddha's life right around Christmas, because we're thinking about, Jesus to some degree, and yeah, that's a good time to talk about the Buddha, have sacred beatings on the dark time. And so the last time we talked about some ways that we can learn from who he was before and the choices he made before he awakened. And this time we're going to talk about some things to learn from who he was after he awakened, which kind of seems like, duh, that's what the Dharma is. And that's true. But there's some actual life things kind of embedded in his life that I think are maybe helpful. Because he's kind of like this vast, daunting figure. Like, how do you relate to the Buddha? He seems so beyond our shtick, our abilities, our awareness right now, that it's hard to know what to do. But it's pretty amazing. And last session, just to check in, it was kind of about like choices. This young Siddhartha prince was making in the face of all kinds of temptations and diversions, and this sort of inner sense he had that awakening was possible, and it kept him going, which is something that we all face in one way or another, is diversions and keeping going, those two poles of the matter. But once he awakened, so this is under the Bodhi tree in the village of Uruvela, which is now called Bodhgaya, but it used to be called Uruvela. His life got a lot more complex. And it's interesting, you read the very early, like the first three suttas, the one when he taught the Four Noble Truths and the one when he taught Not Self, and those are both in Sarnath. And then the third one he taught in Gaya, which is about 12 kilometers from Bodhgaya, to at the fire sermon. You may have heard it, the fire sermon. And to basically, he taught it to a bunch of sadhus who were fire worshippers in Hindu tradition. So he kind of framed it in a way they would understand. But at all those points, they're basically, by that time, I guess there were a bhikkhu or two, because a few people, his five ascetics, had ordained, but there wasn't any big thing. It was pretty much just the Buddha going out there and talking to people. There wasn't even Naya rules. I don't think there was even monastic rules in those first three. So it just got a lot bigger and more complex. And that's right there. That's kind of what our lives are about. We heard from a lot of y'all, your lives are complex, and how do you navigate that? So it's not like his life was that different. For 40 years, he went back and forth across the Ganges plain, kind of about, if I remember right, about 300 miles east and west, and ranging back and forth across the Ganges basin up in northern India. And there was by the end, I don't know how many bhikkhus there were, but I think it's probably in the thousands. And there were all kinds of, there were disputes, there was ill-considered actions, people made mistakes, there was a big splinter at one point, there was a bunch of bhikkhus who misunderstood the teachings and committed suicide at one point. There's all kinds of things that he had to deal with, just like us. Well, hopefully not that, but just like us. So I think it's worth to, I find it really worthwhile to take in his life, because it makes it come more alive, and we can kind of like work with it in a whole different way. And then also, I refrain from ever getting political in any overt sense, but it was really complicated. His political life was really complicated. I mean, there was the overthrow of two kings, both of whom has been his sponsors. Both were overthrown by their sons, or coup d'etats by their sons, who both killed their dads in the process, for starters. And there was outbreaks of war between one of those kingdoms and one to the south. His own Sakya clan was wiped out by the Magadha kingdom, and two of his brothers were killed. So all kinds of stuff happened during his lifetime that was really, really hard. Really hard. So it was complex as anything we got. And there wasn't any like overarching set of laws, a constitution. It was just, it was, you know, wide open. It was wide open. It's really hard to tune into now because we're sort of here, but back then it was just kingdoms floating around. I've kind of gotten a sense of that in Italy, actually. Kingdoms just floating around and fighting each other, and whoever won, won. And there was no order at all. So it's really worth thinking about that. All the suttas you read, all the stuff that's going on. Often when you read the very sutta that's so revealing and so deep, this stuff was going on and around him also. And it's I think it's helpful. So I've read the suttas a lot and kind of thought about his life a lot. So I kind of pulled out 5 key points that are in the suttas but seem helpful to me. So there's a little, you know, how do I say, embarrassingly personal insofar as it's just stuff I've seen, but it's all based on the suttas. So one thing is, he never stopped practicing. And that's actually really worth taking in. Because you might think, oh, he's the Buddha. He could just stop and cruise. You know, why would he keep practicing? But he does. And it's kind of a paradox, but I think it's helpful for us to remember to keep practicing because the Buddha never stopped. And there's lots of different ways you can see that in the suttas. For one thing, lots of the suttas, if the way it's framed, usually it's like after the day's abiding, quote unquote, somebody will appear and then they'll have a conversation. That's the structure of a lot of the suttas. Well, I kind of got a deeper, more visceral sense from being on the pilgrimage that, you know, living in a monastery, there's a meal, which is before noon. So maybe the meal is 9 or 10 o'clock. You know, people go with alms bowls, they come back, they eat the food, clean up, and then it's done. So say you're done by 10 or 11, then the entire day is ahead with nothing to do but practice. And kind of like an old friend of mine who's done a lot of Tibetan, he's not Tibetan, he's Western, but done a lot of Tibetan long solo retreats. And he said, well, you have 3 options in a long retreat. You can really get deep into the Dharma, or you can take up a hobby, or you can go nuts. Because there's nothing else to do. You know, there's no diversions. So you either got to do that. So, I mean, that was my own experience. I didn't go nuts, but the only thing to do is practice. And so I say all this because the Buddha would, after a day's abiding, here he is, Buddha, doesn't have to meditate except he just did all day, and then he talks to this person. So I just think that's pretty, pretty amazing. And so, you know, I think that's a kind of a way to think about how we choose what we do with our time. You know, several people where Bonnie was saying, or Robin Ratter, she'd been doing a lot of practice, and I know Goldie does, and that's really inspiring for me that they both do, and I try to a lot. But, you know, we can all, without getting uptight about it, but keep choosing and kind of remembering how this was part of what he kept doing onwards. So I just think that's something, I mean, it's something I think about reading the suttas, the fact that he practiced a lot. And I just thought I would bring that up. And then he did the 3-month retreats, you know, the rains retreats that is part of the monastic cycle during the monsoon time. The Buddha did them too. So again, he was already enlightened, but he did the 3-month retreats with the monastics. And even there is some, I mean, it's hard to know which suttas are in the middle of the retreat. Many, like I think it's a majority of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya are in Jetavana Monastery, and that's where he did 24 rains retreats more than any place else. He stayed there more than anywhere else. He didn't move around constantly over the 40 years. So it may be that someone would come by, but he often talks to someone, and then he goes back into his hut and practices. So I just think that is so amazing, because he could have just hung out somewhere. You know, he's a highly renowned Buddha at that point with all kinds of doors open. And it's tricky because, you know, I mean, in my weathered self and watching spiritual, you know, teachers do this and that over the decades, that sometimes they do get kind of sucked into wealthy benefactors' houses and sort of start to have a cushy kind of life because people want to take care of them and feed them and be nice to them. And it can be a little tricky. It's a little bit of a slippery slope. And sometimes people slip down it in not so good ways. The Buddha just didn't. He just didn't do that. He'd go to houses, but then he just would leave. You know, wealthy people would invite him. And then also during, and I always struck this in the sutta, is he also took time out to do retreats just in the middle of the rest of the year. In Majjhima Nikaya 128, he goes into seclusion and tells his attendant Meghjiya. So this is prior to the Ananda being his attendant period. He says, "Meghjiya, I am living in solitary retreat for half a month. Let no one come to see me except the one who brings me alms food." So that's a pretty strict boundary. You know, that's like, he's not going to talk to anybody. He's going really deep into retreat. So I just think it's really worth taking into our hearts that this great being had that much of a priority to keep doing practice, even though he was awakened. Because what about us? And the second thing is that he kept his ethics impeccably during his entire life. And that's kind of amazing. You know, he's an awakened being. And again, because I've seen people slip up, you know, it happens in the West a lot. Someone will have a true awakening experience. But because of that, the temptations come thick and fast and they mess up. And it's happened with Asian teachers coming here. And the temptations come thick and fast and they messed up. So he didn't. He just kept that foundation of ethics just completely solid. And even people tried to trick him. You know, there was some situation, I don't know, was it Mara or no, I think it was Devadatta had some woman, they slipped some woman into the ashram, into the monastery, and then she went out and said that she'd been molested or something, and you know, there was a bit of a kerfuffle, and then she said, "Well, actually, I didn't." You know, she confessed that she'd made it up, but there was temptations around, and he just stayed the course. So I just think, you know, for us, that's one baseline to keep cultivating, because we cannot really move forward in the path unless we do keep our ethics clean. And so it's so important to see that he did it. And you remember Mara, because this gets subtle, this business of the ethical choices that the Buddha struggles with. Remember Mara, the sort of personification of evil that shows up on the night of his awakening and throws temptations. His beautiful daughters, Buddha didn't do that, so the attraction didn't work. What about fear? He brought up all kinds of weaponry and soldiers and screaming beasts coming at him, and he didn't yield to that either. But Mara never gives up during the entire life of the Buddha. Up until the very time he died, Mara keeps coming around and seeing like possible weak points, tries to tempt him to let go or to take the easy road. So that's useful for us because we, you know, our own forms of Mara are there. And I think we've, you know, that phrase that shows up in the suttas a lot where he says, "I see you, Mara," blows the cover, and Mara just slinks off kind of disconsolately. So I think it's a great, I know a lot of practitioner friends, and maybe some of you use that as a phrase when you realize, oh, I'm not going to do that. And you say, "I see you, Mara." But he doesn't give up. And, you know, there's 227 rules for monastics. So the Buddha continued to do those. Only ate before noon, didn't own anything, was celibate, didn't accept money, all those things. But Mara gets into subtler ways. In SN 4.5, he pops up and suggests to the Buddha that instead of wasting time being this monk, he should become a wheel-turning monarch with huge power. And then he could really help the world. If he was a wheel-turning monarch, he'd be a great monarch, and that'd be better than being a monk. And he kind of gives this little spiel trying to attract the teacher. Because power, right? I mean, power corrupts, and we see it going on in the world in all kinds of ways. But the Buddha wouldn't buy it. He says, "I'm freed from all snares, both human and divine. You are defeated, end maker," the Buddha says, and Mara slinks off. And then another time, Mara offers him a different possibility. It's just this, like, well, instead of doing, why don't you just have a peaceful life? Just stop this teaching thing, stop being a monk. Just, you know, you're wealthy. Just have a peaceful life and be awakened. And because it's so complicated. You're in such a complicated world. Just chill. But he says, Buddha says, why do you talk of ease, O evil one? Ease is for those who have not gone forth. So isn't that interesting? Because we kind of like think ease is a good thing, which it is, but ease it is not actually ease it is samsarically based. Ease means tends to mean a really nice circumstance. But he was going way deeper than that. So he spurns Mara again. But you can see these subtle layers. It's not just the five precepts in the obvious ways, but it's much subtler because he had this, the Buddha at that point had this responsibility. He had decided to teach right at the beginning. He almost decided not to teach because he thought people wouldn't understand, but he decided to teach. And he's, impacting all these people's lives. So the whole question of ethics gets to be really, really subtle, because if you really look into the five precepts, each one of them is about putting yourself before other. Stealing. If one steals something, it's because you want it for me. I want it for me, and instead of that other person, or sexual misconduct's like that, or lying's like that. The only reason people do all those things is to put themselves ahead of someone else. So here, in a broader way, the Buddha's not putting himself ahead of others. So that's it's I think it's really subtle to keep looking at that and these choices he's continually making in terms of the decisions we make as we go through the path and see, what comes up for each of us uniquely that might divert us or confuse us or make us feel compromised or make us subtly even put ourselves ahead of someone else. And as we penetrate the illusion of self, as we become more aware of not self, it starts to undo that. It's sort of a key element, because what's there to be selfish about if there is no self? If you, the more we start to see through that, it starts to take care of it. But if we go the other way, then we won't see not self just because we made those choices and we concretize. You can see whenever I've even seen, like, if there's a bigger piece of pie and a smaller piece of pie, if I reach for the bigger piece, I can see myself concretizing. It's just amazing to watch. It's like me comes up, And if you go, oh, bigger pie to the other person, then it comes apart. So it's these really subtle little things. And even at the end of the Buddha's life, when his body's falling apart, he talks in the suttas about it being like an ox cart held together with leather straps. He was 80 years old and he'd been walking constantly. The bodies do that. And so Mara comes and says, well, why don't you die sooner? Why keep messing around with this wretched body and you're in pain and all this? Just die now. Get it over with. Everybody, you've done it. And the Buddha refused. He says, I will not pass away, evil one, until I have monks and nuns, laymen and laywomen, accomplished, trained, skilled, learned, and ready to proclaim the Dhamma. So he had this real deep sense of what he was leaving for us back then and wanting to make sure it was ready before he goes. So there's a lot of indications that it was really hard towards the end. You could hardly keep up with Ananda. It was just really hard physically. He was really struggling, but he just kept going. So I love that. I will not pass away, evil ones. So I just find, I think this really is, to me, you really learn something about the importance of sila, of ethics, just from watching how the choices he made and how he conducted himself as an awakened one, right up till the end. And the third one is that he relentlessly gave to all people. He was just incredibly generous. I mean, when was he ever doing anything for himself? I'm glad you came. Happy solstice. When was he ever doing anything for himself? He didn't build, he just didn't. And it's amazing. He could have hung out in cushy situations and he could have done nice things for himself in various ways. He does. He accepts meal offerings. I mean, that would be almost the easiest place. He accepts meal offerings from everybody from prostitutes to workers, two kings, but he doesn't stick around. He just does a teaching and then leaves. And he just was turning toward the need of all beings. It's really amazing that when you read the suttas, you can see it doesn't matter who anybody is. He responds in the same way to that sentient being. There's no sense of favoritism or who's cool or who's not. Just this continual sense of turning away. And that was what Ajahn Ganha kind of was strikingly similar in Thailand. And what this one monk told me, and I could really see, he just turned out and reached people and pulled them in and connected with them. It was very, very beautiful what he did. And also, he just in this, I mean, he grew up at a certain time, you know, 2,600 years ago in India, and he stepped past a lot of the conventions and limitations of the time. And, you know, he always insisted right out of the blocks, there's no question in the suttas that women were fully capable of awakening as men, which might seem like, duh, I get it. But 2,600 years ago, it wasn't duh. Women were property. And in most cultures, not in all cultures, there are matriarchal cultures, I get it. But that was profound. That was not what was going on in India at that time. So for him to say that was extraordinary. And it was a whole question about women taking full ordination, and that's a separate side issue. This can be discussed. But in terms of women's ability to awaken, just like men, he said it real clearly, and had this sort of this real reaching out to women. Women show up all the time in the suttas with questions and thoughts, and he responds. And he says, if a woman goes forth from home into homelessness in the Dhamma and this discipline, she is capable of realizing the fruit of stream entry, once returning, non-returning, and arhantship. So a radical statement at that time, and of course, absolutely true now. And then he always responded to requests for help. And this is one amazing story where there was a monk in one of the monasteries who was sick with dysentery in his kuti somewhere, just all covered with shit and everything. He was in a gross situation, and the Buddha comes in, and this guy is sick, and he personally and Ananda go and clean up, get new clothes, clean them up, wash them down. And then the Buddha went, and because they asked in the sutta, he asked, why isn't anyone helping you? And he says, oh, they've just been staying away. You know, I'm just not likable, something like that. And so he, after he cleans up, he talks to the monks and he says, monks, you have no mother, you have no father who might tend to you. If you don't tend to one another, who then will tend to you? Whoever would tend to me should tend to the sick. So he's pushing people to just take care of, you know, people who aren't as pleasant to be around and all that, this constant turning outward, this constant kindness. So I think that's really, you know, it's important because, you know, when we sort of think about the Buddha, we think about his wisdom and his insight, but it's not so easy to think about just how relentlessly kind he was to people. I mean, it's really amazing. And that's something to really take in because, you know, that's sort of, again, over the, you know, decades of spiritual stuff in the West, there's some people who haven't done the kind thing so well, who are pretty, and I'm not talking about Buddhists, anybody, you know, there's lots of different sort of traditions floating around and how do I say, West sort of coming out of Asia, contemplative stuff, whether it's Zen or yogic stuff or all those kind of stuff. But sometimes the kindness thing gets left in the dust a little bit and people are claiming wisdom, or maybe they even have some wisdom, but if they forget to be kind, it doesn't work. So the Buddha was kind. And even at the very end, I love this story, just before he died, he's in Kushinagar, he's flat on the ground, can't go any further between the two sal trees, he's dying, Ananda gets he's dying, and this guy comes up, he's an ascetic, so he was not Buddhist, he was, you know, a wandering sadhu of some sort, Subhata. Anyway, he asked for teachings, and Ananda said, no, please, you have to go away, the Buddha is very sick, and the Buddha overhears and said, no, let him come. He wants to offer. He's lying down, can hardly even move, and he gives a teaching. He says, enough, Ananda, do not prevent Subhata. Let him see the Tathagata. Whatever Subhata may ask me, he will ask for the sake of knowledge and not to trouble me. and whatever I may say in answer to his questions, that he will quickly understand. So to be sure, the Buddha got it, where this guy was coming from, and he ordains him right on the spot, and he swiftly awakens. Subhata does with him. He becomes an arhat right after that, I think, if I remember. But just this sense of this incredible compassion, you know, right in the middle of dying, he reaches out to this person who just comes out of left field without an appointment. So worth thinking about, just in terms of our own humble selves. And I think for me, it's like just to, I mean, I don't know about y'all, but I'm kind of a quiet person, so I tend to kind of lean back a little bit. It's a little hard for me to reach out, or, you know, when I'm downtown for alms round, there's a lot of strange, you know, I get off at the bus at Westlake and walk to the market. So that's a pretty interesting stretch. That's like one of the funkier parts of downtown. There's all kinds of curious things going on, and people come up to you for money and all that. And I'm imperfect. I try. And I give people money sometimes and kind of back away other times, and it's hard, but it's a challenge, you know? And I can see, hiding behind this comfort, the Buddha just kept reaching out. So it's very, very worthwhile. And I think a point is to turn toward others when it's hard, not just when it's easy, like with all these things, you know, telling the truth when it's hard, not just when it's easy, all these things. So he really did it. He really did it. And, you know, it sort of brings up, what do we do? How do we, you know, how do we act in the world? Do we volunteer? I know some people here volunteer, some people active in Dharma groups doing different things, you know, whatever. I mean, there's no judgment about people of different phases of their life, but whatever moves you to do something for others, you know, it's good to do. It's really good to do. Just keep the energy moving, and to turn toward the needs away from self, toward the needs of others. It's, Buddha never stopped doing that. And the more we can parallel with that, it's key on the path for sure. And the fourth is that the Buddha, he believed anyone could awakening, no matter their previous actions. This is really striking. It's just one of the things I love about the suttas, because it gets at, you know, the ways in which we judge people, you know, the whole political divisiveness thing, and all the people we think are wrong wherever we're coming from. Everybody's thinking someone else is wrong right now, and certainly in our political world, and all kinds of people on different sides thinking the other person is wrong. It's pretty wild. And therefore, there's something wrong with them, and therefore they're flawed. That's kind of where we go. Buddha just did not do that. No matter who, he thought, he saw, he related to them in the way that they could awaken. And there is no, you know, there is no other, there is no flaw. That's part of what we learn from practice, but this is where it really hits us in the heart. You know, there's no inherent self anywhere that can be intrinsically flawed, but it's hard for us to convince ourselves of that. But the Buddha just lived it. And you can, and Dalai Lama's like that too. You can see, if you sort of tune into where the Buddha was coming from, you can see his sense of not self was so profound that any obstacles which presented themselves to him, he just knew they were obstacles, but they weren't the person. And so this is a, you know, it's since not self and emptiness are just right, you know, at the core of where wisdom is, but this is a place where we really get a chance to exercise it in our lives, find the person we think is no good at all, and then go past that. Because ultimately, that no good person does not exist. And the Buddha did that. And so again, this is where you can kind of look at what he did and sort of bring that into our lives and see what we can learn from it. And, you know, without giving the whole story, but the most vivid, Angulimala, we did a whole teaching about that one time, because he's so amazing, who the Buddha nurtured to be an arhat after Angulimala killed 99 people and tried to kill the Buddha as his 100th victim. He had this necklace of fingers of people he'd killed. But the Buddha saw he could awaken, and he did. There's a stupa in India where Angulimala's remains are buried. So it's kind of astonishing. I mean, that's way worse than in a sense. I mean, you could argue different ways, but at least he, with his hands, killed 99 people. I know other despots kill other people in other ways, so whatever, but he did. And then there's also, there's this great sutta when, I have trouble pronouncing this, Ajatashatru, see what I mean? The son of Bimbisara, who had killed his father. And there's this great sutta I've talked about before where he approaches the Buddha and says, I've been feeling really kind of disconsolate and uncertain, sort of a little bit of a despair. And the Buddha gives us this incredible teaching, because it's really a long sutta about the many stages of practice to this person who, by the way, killed his best friend, basically, eye to eye. And then towards the end, just because it goes so deep, the son kind of starts feeling, he kind of like, it's almost like he clarifies his remorse. He was just feeling disconsolate. Then he actually says, you know, actually, I probably shouldn't have killed my wonderful father. That probably wasn't something I should have done. And he expresses remorse. And the Buddha says, indeed, King, you have done a transgression. You have engaged in wrong conduct. But because you acknowledge the transgression and make amends for it, in accordance with the Dhamma, we accept it. For it is growth in the Noble One's discipline that when seeing a transgression as such, one makes amends for it in accord with the Dhamma and attains restraint in the future. So he doesn't admonish him, he doesn't judge him, he just turns him ahead. And then the son says, okay, thank you, I'm very busy, I got to go, and he leaves. And the Buddha said, you know, had he not done that, he would have awakened right there, because he had that potential. But nonetheless, he does, according to other suttas, awaken later on. So it's just this sense of, even these people who did horrendous things, they could. So, of course, what about us? We've messed up, I'm sure, all I have, but, you know, we can. And anyone we relate to, anyone that's out there that we're judging, to take in how the Buddha looked at them and try to look in that way, like, could they awaken? If the Buddha was sitting there, how would the Buddha relate to those people? How does that inform how we are? I find it really helpful. And it does, you know, I think this is a way in which the Dharma really does get at that divisiveness, because it starts to fall away. You know, whatever despot or political person we find just appalling, okay, but they could awaken. They can awaken. So that's pretty amazing. And this is where it gets subtle in terms of our own practice, because if we do let ourselves judge that one person, then we're, you know, insofar as we're trying to see the true nature of things, which means that all things lack inherent existence, which means that nothing has inherent self, and then we blow it by judging a person, it doesn't help us either. You know, we just threw up a roadblock on our own journey. So it really is worth it to just keep stretching ourselves and look at, you know, causes and conditions, all these compounded phenomena that make people do weird things. Any being can become a Buddha. And the last thing is that the Buddha experienced pain just like us, but he didn't suffer. And this is, I mean, I just think this is so important. You know, he experienced pain, but he didn't suffer. And you start to clarify, I think it's really, we even had a discussion with the LDLs, the local Dharma leaders, the other day, and that the distinction, you know, between pain and dukkha is hard for people to get at. But pain, it just happens in life. The Buddha suffered a lot of pain in his life, but he didn't suffer because he had awakened. So all of us probably experience pain at different times. We do. It's inherent in the nature of a human life. But to be able to really like breathe with that and say, okay, we can experience pain, but we don't have to suffer, and then work with the path in that way. And so, because it's easy to kind of sort of fantasize the Buddha's situation and think, oh, it must have been all kind of hunky-dory, and he was the Buddha and everybody was loving him, and so he probably didn't experience any pain, but may not, he did. And in fact, he had a bunch of stuff. He had back problems, he had headaches, and at one point he had kind of a double situation, because his the evil cousin, well, not intrinsically evil, But his cousin Devadatta, who was trying to overthrow the Sangha, who did all kinds of difficult stuff, also tried to roll a boulder on the Buddha to kill him at one point, and the boulder broke and he got a stone splinter. The Buddha got a stone splinter in his foot from it. And there's this great, and also his own clan was conquered, like I said earlier, you know, during his lifetime. His brothers, too, both brothers were killed. That's so heartbreaking. I didn't get the brothers part. I just picked that up when I was doing some research for this. But there's a way if you can get at it that he experienced pain, but you kind of feel what's going on in the suttas and how he's talking about things. He's not suffering in the way that we would because he's awakened. So it's really, really helpful to kind of breathe that in and see what it means in terms of our own journey. And, you know, to do, I mean, how do I say? Everybody that's a practitioner has already moved significantly in that direction. Because I talk to a lot of people, and just people we meet out there, you know, something goes wrong, they go in a complete tailspin, and they're hysterical, and they just lose it, and they think it's me, and they desperately want it to end, and all that kind of stuff. Most practitioners I know, they don't go into tailspins like that. I mean, it hurts, and it sucks, but they are like, okay, this is what's happening, and they deal. And they feel it, and they're present at the same time. I mean, most people, you know, everybody I know, you know, there's some things that people have said over the years, like everybody here's doing that to varying degrees. And it's, so you're already way farther along than you might think you are in terms of feeling pain and not suffering. The Buddha was awakened, so it wasn't a level that we can't understand yet. But nonetheless, it's a real pointer to what we're doing and what this path is about. So we don't have to stop feeling pain. That ain't going to happen in order to stop suffering. We need to wake up in order to stop suffering. And the Buddha just kind of lived, you know, in this equanimity, no matter what happened. And about this foot thing, in the sutta it says, sharp pain arose in the Blessed One's foot, intense, excruciating, harrowing, disagreeable, and unpleasant. But the Blessed One endured it, mindful and clearly aware, without becoming distressed. So that was pretty gnarly there, but he endured it. So that's about it. Pain happens, suffering is optional. Good to breathe in. Let's sit for a moment.